Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly storytelling event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage.
On this show, we'll feature stories about love. We'll pull stories from a couple of our Arctic Entries live events to bring you a full hour of the mushy stuff.
All right, here we go. These stories are about how they met and how it worked.
Or how it didn't work, like in Miranda Hall's case.
One way your date can let you know how well the evening is going is by the number of times he cries. Gregory let me know 3 times.
All of these stories were originally told at a live Arctic Entries event at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage. Live events occur the second Tuesday of each month.
Today, we'll hear from a couple who met on a mountain. Sandy Harper of Cyrano's Off-Center Playhouse in Anchorage will tell her story. And the founders of Arctic Entries, James and Tara, will share their lovely tale.
Our first story was originally told in May 2012. Harry Crawford weaves a story about coming to Alaska as a young man and eventually finding love. Here he is, live at Arctic Entries.
I'm Harry Crawford, and I'm a Democrat. Les Garrett told me to say that so I could get everybody's sympathy. This is a story about helping to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and how I became the happiest and richest iron worker in Valdez, Alaska in 1975. I wanted to come to Alaska so long ago that I can't even remember really what was my first impetus to come here. I know that Johnny Horton had a hand in it. John Wayne had a hand in it. Jack London had a hand in it. And Dick Kearney had a hand in it. And My hometown is Shreveport, Louisiana, and that's where Johnny Horton's from. And in 1959, the number one song for 26 weeks was North to Alaska. It was well imprinted on my mind. And then after that, I read anything that I could get from Jack London. Also, Bret Hart, anything on the North Country, I just lapped it up. Anytime somebody mentioned Alaska, they had my absolute full attention. And Dick Kearney, my cousin, was a jet pilot, and he was a corporate pilot for ARCO. And in my senior year of high school, he came home for Christmas, and he said, "So, Harry, what are you going to do when you graduate from high school?" I said, "Oh, I guess I'm going to college. I don't know." And he said, "You should forget about college and everything else and go to Alaska and go to work on that pipeline. It's going to be the gold rush of the 20th century. It's going to be the biggest dadgum thing that's ever happened in Alaska." And I said, "Ooh, I like that idea." It sounded like just the thing to do. Well, I saw in the back of a magazine a little ad said, "Send $5 for Alaska pipeline jobs." So I sent the $5, and they sent me back a packet of information, said, write to these people. I wrote to them and said, "You know, I'm Harry Crawford. I want to go to work." And they said, a couple of them actually wrote back and said, "What do you know how to do?" I don't. Nothing. <You know? laughs> And anyway, one of them sent a list of skills, you know, carpenter, pipe fitter, iron worker, cement finisher, all of those things. So I said, oh. I went to the youth employment center, and a guy there said, oh, you want to be a construction worker? You need to go look in the yellow pages under labor organizations and get in an apprenticeship program. Well, I became an iron worker. I walked into the iron workers. They handed me a tool belt, sent me out, and 30 minutes later, I was working as an iron worker. Didn't know anything, but I made a paycheck. That was in 1971. And by 1975, I was a journeyman iron worker. My partner and I, Bruce Hughes, drove up the highway with a 1972 Scout and a 25-foot travel trailer, and we joined several thousand other boomers that were coming up here to work on the pipeline, and we were really hurrying so nobody would get ahead of us. I got a job out in Valdez, and I worked out there for several weeks, building the camp, unloading barges, working on the tank farm. And one evening, I was in the mess hall with about 600 other iron workers. I mean, not iron workers, construction workers, all the different crafts. And, you know, it was rowdy, just like it was in here. And you could barely hear yourself think. And then all of a sudden, my life took a big fork in the road. Wasn't one that I saw coming, but it surely did change things, because all of a sudden it got really quiet in there. And all the heads turned around and they looked at the door, and there were two women standing in that door. This is 1975, when they didn't have any women on construction sites. And these two women were there, and it was just like E.F. Hutton had spoken. Every eye was on them. And as they eased around the side, some guy growled. And Gwen, my wife, who's sitting right over there, jumped. And the whole place roared because every eye was upon her. And that's what it was for the next 2.5 years. And she was able to withstand all of that attention, still come out through it, being friendly and open, and probably one of the best known people in Valdez. You know, when I was doing this rehearsal, I kind of ended up the story about this point, and they said, "Wait a minute, hold on, how did you get the girl? <You know? laughs> How did you get the girl out of all those hundreds of construction workers?" So we had a Sunday off, the first Sunday off in several weeks, and I went and asked Gwen, who I really hadn't talked to very much because, you know, there were always 20 other guys there trying to talk at the same time. And I said, "Hey, we're going to have Sunday off. Would you like to go out on a date with me? Would you like to go do something?" She said, "Sure." And I went, "Oh, my God." Well, unbeknownst to me, several people, like maybe dozens, had asked her as well. And she was looking for the best offer, you know. So I was one of the ones that didn't make the cut. So Saturday morning came before the Sunday, and I said, so are you all ready to go? And she said, but I'm going to Lake Louise with this guy named Don McPhee. That's only 37 years ago. I still remember. So I said, oh, well, it figures. And She said, oh, well, I could come see you after I get back. I said, no, don't bother. So that bothered her. So Sunday night, I made sure that I was at the in the rec hall, and she came in, and I could see that she was looking. So I figured it must be me. And it was. So she came over to talk to me, and we went and had several long, serious talks and a big walk on the beach. And I said, either we are or we aren't. I don't want to be like two ships passing in the night. And she said, well, couldn't you just go away for a couple of years and then come back? I said, no, either we are or we aren't. And here we are.
So stand up, sweetheart. And Beau and Andrew. That's how I became the luckiest and richest iron worker in Valdez. Thank you.
That was Harry Crawford, and you're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with seven Alaskans to share their stories at our live event held the second Tuesday of each month. Anyone may volunteer to tell a story at our live events. For more on that, visit arcticentries.com.
Crawford's story was sweet. Either we are or we aren't. That's gutsy.
It sure worked for him.
Mm-hmm. And our next story has a happy ending as well. Here's Matt and Heather Zindi sharing how they met.
Well, thank you very much. We're really happy to be here. And our story is that we met on climbing the West Buttress in 2002. And it was my eighth expedition guiding. And Heather was on a private expedition with her three teammates who are actually all in this room tonight, which is wonderful. And when I first met Heather, she looked a lot like this. And she hadn't showered for 15 days. So we did not smell like peaches, either of us. But we were somewhere between base camp and Camp One, and I was leading my team to Camp One, and you were coming back to base camp, and we passed, and she looked at me like that, and she said, I recognize you from Argentina. But with this cute voice and this really cute smile, she's got a cute smile. And I was like, really? I don't know who you are. So
the previous year, I climbed Aconcagua in Argentina. The climbing team that we had passed on the Camp One carry day was from a guide service that I'd met on Aconcagua, or so I thought. I knew I recognized one of the guides from the passing team, but in the few seconds we stopped to chat, we couldn't place how we knew each other yet.
So when you're climbing Denali, you've got a lot of time on your hands. You've got, first of all, you've got a lot of distance between you and the next person, so you have peace and quiet, and you have 10 hours of walking or skiing, and so it's a very sort of, you've got a lot of time to think, which we all the climbers and skiers love about being in the wilderness. So for the life of me, for the rest of the day, I could not think of where I knew this person, just racking my brain. And then as we climbed the mountain, we were on the same ascent profile, so we'd, you know, carry to Camp 1, move to Camp 1, carry to Camp 2, move to Camp 2. By the time we got to 14 camp, I'd seen her a couple times, but finally when I rolled into 14 camp, I saw her tents, and I was able to park my team semi close to her tents, because I was curious. So 14 camp, by the way, is like a 20 below party. I mean, people are playing hacky sack and frisbee and, you know, flying kites and mostly eating. You know, it's all about food. So as a guide service, what we do is we feed our clients really, really well. We cook a lot of food, make sure everyone's real fed. And then we, rather than having to carry the extra food down the mountain, we go around camp and feed other climbers who might be hungry. So that was a great strategy to kind of have a good excuse to swing by Heather's camp and talk to her folks and feed people and get to know her a little bit better. So I did that, and little did I know that I was going to help save her life the next day.
So on around day 4 of the snowstorm at 14 Camp, Matt and I had time to actually talk, uninterrupted. We sat in the falling snow, each bundled up, getting to know each other. In talking about Argentina, we realized the first time we met was in Mendoza when we had coffee with Matt's good friend. Then we talked about philosophical perspectives, our life histories, goals, spirituality, and intellectual pursuits. Our intellectual connection was so strong, it felt as if time stopped for us. It had also felt as if my whole life up to that point had happened for a reason, just to meet Matt again. We both acknowledged the fate of our second meeting and how much we had had in common. The next day, Becky and I were offered real bacon and eggs if we cooked breakfast for the ranger camp. So, of course, we took them up on it. Who wouldn't have? But after the meal, Becky and I began feeling strange. So we left our tents to take a nap. My climbing partner, Jeff, who's in the back over there, nicknamed Hardcore, was the most experienced, 20-plus years all of our seniors, and focused more than all of us. He kind of got mad at Becky and me for getting distracted. But he was right. I was enjoying meeting and talking to people from all parts of the world and was really losing focus on climbing. But after a bit of an argument, I passed out in the tent next to Jeff with an excruciating headache.
So I came by later that day to touch base with Heather. We had such an intense connection the day before and stormy weather up high. And, my clients were not the most enthralling clients that particular expedition. So I'm like poking around, looking for things to do and people to talk to. And most importantly, again, I had a real strong connection with Heather. I went to say hi, and she wouldn't get out of the tent, and that was odd. Usually that's one thing, like right when you roll into 14 to not feel well, but day 5 you should feel really good at that altitude. She had a splitting headache, and her pulse, resting pulse, was 120. And I thought, wow, that's really weird. And I talked to Becky, and her headache was less, but it was weird. We tried to figure out what the problem was, and I decided it was worth to go talk to the medical doc at 14 Camp. The National Park Service has a medical contingent there. And I explained to the rangers, and they said, yeah, it's worth checking out. But they also knew that they helped contribute to the problem, so they were downplaying a little bit. But anyway, they came over, and they said, yeah, she needs to get some medical attention. So we brought her back over to medical camp. We put her on 10-liter flow oxygen to get the CO out of her system. She got CO poisoning from frying the bacon in the little tent. So in the meantime, the weather had improved, and my clients, I had to get back to work. So I went over to my team, and I said goodbye to Heather, hoping I'd see her again, and I had to go up to high camp and took my team up to high camp, and Becky and Bridge also made their way up there.
Yeah, and so while I was recovering from carbon monoxide poisoning, my other teammates, Becky and Bridge, went up to high camp for a summit attempt and left with all the climbers that day, while Jeff and I stayed behind at 14 Camp in the desolate, deserted camp for me to try to recover. All the while, my thoughts had turned to the fact that in a few days, my time on Denali was ending, which had meant that Matt and I would be parting ways because he lived in Washington and I lived in Anchorage.
So 4 days up at high camp, I was concentrating on my job, but I was also really worried about this person who I'd made a really strong connection with. Again, not physically, because she had, I couldn't tell what she looked like at all. So emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. But at the same time, I was really excited. So I came back down to 14 camp, and there she was, happy and healthy and strong and smiling and, happy to see everybody. And on our way down the mountain, we decided that, maybe we should try to head off to Chena Hot Springs to thaw out. And, part of that is like, well, what does she look like? And so...
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
You just heard from Matt and Heather Zundi. Stories this hour are told by Alaskans who know a thing or two about love. Now, Miranda Hall is about to put us in her shoes. She was very new to Alaska when she originally told this story in November 2011.
Miranda moved here from Baltimore, the birthplace of Stoop Stories, which is an event that's very similar to Arctic Entries. You'll hear more about that later in the show. But through this story, we'll take chances with Miranda as she learns some things about compatibility, or, more fittingly, lack of compatibility.
Here's Miranda Hall, live at the Snow Goose in Anchorage.
Yes, this is a love story. And like all great love stories, it begins in France. And like all great French stories, it begins in Paris on a rainy Saturday night. And you are ascending from the metro, bound for a date with your newfound guy, who may just be the love of your life. And you met him a week earlier at a Sunday morning market when he struck up a conversation. And you realized that he was the most handsome Frenchman that you had ever seen. He had that sort of grungy, arty elegance about him that just made your girlish heart go nuts. And this was before you knew about extra tufts. But you agreed to go on a date with him in a well-lit public place. Because you believe in falling in love, and you believe in free dinner. So here you are, and you're scanning the cafe looking for your beau, and you spot a familiar face, and you realize that it's connected to the body of a man that, though it's mid-February, is wearing a tight white sweater and tight white pants and a bright pink scarf and a bright pink jacket. And he's sitting like this. And you think to yourself, huh, is my soulmate a gay man? But because you believe in falling in love and because you believe in free dinner, you brace yourself and march ahead straight into an evening of disaster. And 3 years later, you find yourself in Anchorage. And in an attempt to counterbalance your karma, you decide that you should share the lessons you learned on that eventful night with Gregory to help the poor people of Alaska who could be faced with a similar situation. I call this lesson, How You Know He's Not Your Soulmate. Lesson one. When you're sitting sipping wine and you tell him you're a playwright and he tells you he loves Shakespeare and you tell him you love Shakespeare, and he excuses himself from the table. And you see him consulting his smartphone and mouthing some things to himself. And when he returns and coyly winks and begins reciting some lines, you know, Miranda, he's not your soulmate. Especially when you realize that he's reciting Richard III. Lesson two. Anyone who really digs a theatrical experience involving tapestries, say, is bound to be a catch. But when someone takes you to a backroom production of something a lot like Moulin Rouge, but involving a few more painted-on mustaches and a lot more of this gesture, then you can be sure that this date is an emissary of every failed former relationship that you have ever had, disguised as a naked woman flailing herself around the stage to slap you in the face. Lesson 3. No matter how much your date waxes poetic about how much he loves salad, if he then decides to dress his greens with an entire bottle of Tabasco, you can be sure that your date is a pathological liar. Lesson 4. One way your date can let you know how well the evening is going is by the number of times he cries. Gregory let me know 3 times. And as I suspected at the time and research later confirmed, this is, in fact, 3 times too many. Lesson 5. When the waiter comes over and asks you if the smell of smoke offends you, and you say, partially because you've run out of other things to say, and partially because it's true, that no, you enjoy the smell of burnt out candles, and your date gets a glimmer in his eye and asks, oh, are you a pyromaniac? Resist the urge to remind your date that pyromaniacs typically prefer lit candles to extinguished ones. And be wary of the glimmer in his eye when you ask politely, well, are you a pyromaniac? And he gives you a gesture like this and says, well, I'm a pyromaniac when 2 souls ignite. It is, in fact, an appropriate moment to start to end the date. And you might be thinking, wow, this girl is just using Arctic Entries as one enormous classified ad. But I assure you, I am. But also, I want to remind all of you, no, soulmate or no, to always say yes to falling in love, and always say yes to free dinner in France. And when you can turn bad karma into really great stories, you always finish with the upper hand. Thank you.
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. That was Miranda Hall.
This hour, we hear Alaskans tell 7-minute true stories. You may have noticed the timer by now. At 5 minutes, the hosts give our Arctic Entry storytellers a warning. And then another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it is time to tie things up.
Now we'd like to play you a live recording from local musician Emma Hill's performance at Arctic Entries. Emma is known for her songs about love, but most of them stem from heartbreak rather than happy endings.
They say with love you just have to simply leap. If I didn't need the boat to run, I'd cut off my 2 feet. I spent the last 2 years avoiding love, 'cause I had started fierce and I had started young. I backed up quick after a few good burns, afraid of all the heartache and the wretched empty hurt. How this feeling works, how your heart just goes on beating. And I could hate you for reminding me, or just love myself for trying. My heart is trapped in this room. My heart is trapped in this room. My heart is trapped in this room, buried between all the black and wretched blue. Left 1,000 tears in your bed. You left these unwanted feelings in my chest. I am always the fool, but at least I could admit that I was in love with you. get out of this feeling worse. I heart just goes on beating, and I could age you for reminding me, or just love myself for trying. My heart is trapped in this room. My heart is trapped in this, and my heart is trapped in this room, buried between all the black and wretched blue.
You just heard a live recording from our May 2012 event. That was Emma Hill.
You're listening to Arctic Entries. Each show features 7-minute long true stories from our live event held the second Tuesday of each month in Anchorage. And as you just heard, we also showcase a bit of local music.
On this episode of Arctic Entries, our theme is love. Our next story is from longtime Alaskan Sandy Harper. Harper is the founder and managing director of Cyrano's Theater Company. Here is her ode to the love of her life, Jerry Harper. Sandy originally shared this on Valentine's Day, 2011.
Thank you, guys. Well, actually, this story is all about yes, the courage to say yes, the courage to stand in front of a bunch of people who are not your immediate loving family and tell a story. In fact, I have the greatest respect for storytellers and actors. I think they have stomachs of steel and are the bravest people in the world. And actually, Helen Maude was part of my inspiration to say yes to tell this story, because Maude has long been my philosophical role model, because she has a zest for life, and part of her model is to say yes to do something new every day. But the real reason I said yes was the opportunity to have a Valentine to Jerry, who was the love of my life, my husband of 43 years, my best friend, and the reason we have a theater, and a real authentic visionary. I will go on with the story. He was an extraordinary and gifted actor and director. And it's because of him we actually have this theater. We inherited this theater from Zach Lusack, his stepdad. And at that time, Tony Knowles was the mayor of Anchorage, and he was on a campaign for urban renewal. This space at that time was a major liquor store at 4th and D. So he was very emphatic and encouraging us to rehab the building and have a different tenant. So we said yes. And we went into debt for $1.5 million to rehab the building. Now, you think your student loan's taking a long time to pay off? We're still paying. But listen, before the ink was dry on the loan papers, the Alaska economy tanked. I mean, it crashed. Banks were falling like dominoes. People were walking away from property. But we did have a tenant, and it was the police department. They had a 5-year lease. So we customized the space for them. And I want you all to know how very safe you are in this building, because the windows on 4th Avenue are bulletproof. But when they only had a 5-year lease, so Jerry and I had that Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney conversation. Okay, I'm an actor, you're a producer, let's have a theater. And so we did. But before that, we had Cyrano's, and maybe some of you remember it. It started in 1987. It was an incredible bookstore cafe. We had all kinds of special events. We had music, we had art shows, and we had a cinema. In fact, we like to call ourselves a cultural mini-mall. Things were going great until 1995, when both Borders and Barnes & Noble decided to move to Anchorage. So we just couldn't compete with these corporate entities. So more and more and more and more, the focus went to the theater. And as you can imagine, the theater is a great life. One week, I was married to King Lear. One week, I was married to Lady Bracknell. Yeah, Lady Bracknell. Jerry had played every other part in The Importance of Being Earnest, so he wanted to give it a go. And his most flattering comment was when people said, "Who's that new actress in town?" And he also played The Merchant of Venice. He played Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, and he did it with such humanity that the rabbi from Reish Shalom wrote a compass piece in the ADN. Now, you guys will have a chance to see Jerry, because on March 1st, to launch our birthday tribute to Tennessee Williams' 100th birthday, we're going to show our archive version of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And, of course, Jerry played Big Daddy. Of course, he had a life besides the theater. I will tell you one of his adventures. And that was when he was a lion tamer in a small circus in Oregon. Now, his friend owned this circus, and he said, "Jerry, would you just kind of do it for me for a few days while I go away?" He said, "The lions won't notice there's a new guy if you master cracking the whip." So he did practice cracking the whip. However, the days he was doing it, I stood by the cage with a pitchfork instead of a camera, just in case he hadn't mastered it. But that would only be one of my few regrets in life, because I would really have loved to have a picture of Jerry being a lion tamer. Now, he loved lots of things. He loved Scrabble, he loved golf, he loved poker, he loved World War I airplanes. Of course, he loved his daughters and his grandchildren. And he loved ice cream. On our first date, we polished off a half a gallon of chocolate chip ice cream. So I knew we had a shared passion. And as a matter of fact, on our anniversaries, for a long time, we used to go to Baskin-Robbins and have a scoop of 31 flavors each. I wouldn't try that if I were you, because it does turn into kind of a mush. I should tell you where we met. We met at a Halloween party. And I came as a Fellini movie. He came as himself. And, you know, Jerry was a man of just impeccable integrity, a hilarious sense of humor. He made me and everyone else laugh. And if there were tough times, and there's always a few tough times, he would make lemonade. So I also drank a lot of sweet lemonade during our 43 years together. We used to joke about when we died. We would be cremated, and then we'd have some fine potter make a vase out of us. But when we dismissed that idea, when we were kind of considered maybe our daughter would accidentally sell us at a yard sale or something. So when Jerry finally did pass, we had a celebration of life for him at the Wendy Williamson. You guys might know that place holds 1,000 people, and it was standing room only. So I wasn't the only person who loved and appreciated Jerry. The entire community did. Because it is Valentine's, I want to pass on, as an elder, a few tips. And that is, write love notes. And because later on, those love notes mean a great deal. And I still read mine from Jerry. And trust me, they make me very happy. And of course, there's the traditional advice. Hug your loved one every day. Enjoy all the small moments in life. And most important, tell that person you love them every day. So I would also say, always say yes to your loved one. And while I'm on yes, I would like to quote Molly Bloom from James Joyce's Ulysses. And she always said, yes, 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 but I'm going to add, hell yes, because it's important. And if I haven't heard that little ding, I thought, well, I could fill in this time. With inviting an interactive yes from you guys. So, give me a why. Give me an E.
E.
Give me an S.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That was Sandy Harper, founder of Cyrano's Theater in Anchorage.
You're listening to Arctic Entries. To hear that story and more, visit our website at arcticentries.com.
Our final love story on this show is told by James Keck and Tara Lloyd, the founders of Arctic Entries. Keck and Lloyd moved to Anchorage from Baltimore in 2009 and quickly put together a small storytelling event based on Stoop stories, which they had seen in Baltimore.
This story was originally told right after Sandy Harper's story in February 2011. Sandy called the two up to the stage rather unexpectedly, but as hosts of a storytelling event should, they pulled it off. Here, just listen.
Sir James and I met on the first day of public health school in the year... Oh! On the way into the theater tonight. Is that good?
What was happening is I was looking for a cookie. We had a boxed lunch at the orientation, and it didn't have a cookie. And being from the Midwest, I'm very used to having a cookie with my lunch. So I went to the activities fair and was sort of distraught. Where's the cookie? Where's the cookie? Maybe they'll have some cookies at the activities fair. So I wandered over to one of my new classmates that I already met, and he was talking to this good-looking woman, and I sort of said, hey, you know, has anyone seen a cookie?
So the classmate that I was talking to was somebody I'd gone to college with and hadn't seen for a decade, a guy named Danny. And he and James were part of a cohort smaller than the whole public health school class of 300 people, but just these like 10 or 12 people who were studying preventive medicine. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know what that was, but it sounded nice. The date?
Yeah, so throughout that first week, we ran into each other and sort of talked a lot and kept saying, you know, we should meet some other people in this class. You know, let's go do that. I saw that there's going to be some music in the park that weekend. I thought, this will be fun. You know, I'm new to town. So I invited a bunch of people to this music in the park, and only one person came. And she came in a sundress and a convertible.
So over my sundress, though, I was wearing a denim jacket, and I had on, I think, my boots, because I had just...
It was 85 and humid.
At least, like total sweaty, gross, sticky Baltimore summer weather with the top down and my convertible. But I had just returned from my fourth trip to Southern Africa, where I'd been living on and off throughout my 20s, and... It's a very conservative culture, and women don't show their skin because it's very sexual and it's totally inappropriate. And I was doing HIV and tuberculosis work in the rural mountains. And so even though I understood myself to be in Baltimore and maybe going on a date, I still thought, like, probably best, you know, to put the jacket on over the sundress and wear the tall boots.
So... not always being the smoothest man and having some training in medicine, I at one point said, oh, are you okay? Or maybe you should take off your jacket, or do you have a skin condition? So actually the rest of the evening went very well. We listened to the music. We talked a lot. We sat out in the park. We had sushi. We ended with some organic gelato on the pier in the inner harbor of Baltimore. It was probably 7 hours. She dropped me back off. Little did I know that she was actually not even staying in Baltimore, but staying with an aunt and uncle like an hour and a half south of Baltimore, and she had driven all the way for this music. So I think... let me see, 3.5 minutes. So I think there's, I was very taken with this experience. It was a very strong connection, I thought. I was very comfortable So I sent a text message to a friend. I know, I got home and I sent a text message at 1 a.m. to a friend in Minnesota saying, I may have found her. And I'm not really a sappy kind of guy, so I think this startled my friend. Who responded, like, found what, where, who?
So I saw that text message on James's phone really almost a year ago about this time. Sort of fast forward through a lot of things. We moved up here because we put Anchorage on a list of places we were willing to let the CDC place us. Not that we were really looking to be put in Anchorage, just that we were willing to be put in Anchorage. And then we were selected to go to Anchorage, and I cried in front of like the head of the Centers for Disease Control.
And he said, don't worry, it's not that cold.
But I was crying because I thought that I had been accepted to a job in Baltimore and that we would have to leave each other because of this. And then what we were going to do, was I going to give up my job? And, you know, just sort of one of those moments in your life where you look back and think, like, I'm really glad that they didn't give me that job and that I could get in James's 1982 green Toyota Land Cruiser, which shifts on the left and is sort of hard to drive, and drive all the way up here and arrive last August because of his amazing fellowship opportunity. And I have, of course, fallen in love with Anchorage and you guys and this community. And I think we'll skip to the proposal and conclude. What do you think?
Okay.
Okay.
So one wintry day, about a year ago, Tara says, hey, let's go for a hike. I say, okay. Hey, how about we call some friends, you know? Well, I don't know. Yeah, let's just go for a hike. So we head off, and she has packed up a bag, and we're walking up Flat Top, and it is really windy, and the snow is just blowing, and it's deep, and she's from Kentucky. She actually doesn't really like the cold. So I was a little bit surprised as to why she was really pushing so much for this hike in this not-so-nice weather. But I'd already seen her. I mean, she had the jackets on, but I knew what she looked like. So it was good. So we decided we probably aren't going to walk that far because it's windy. So we stopped maybe, you know, 200 feet from the parking lot. And she looks at me in the eyes, and I look back, and I feel that there's something very important that's about to happen. And she takes off her big mittens, and she reaches into her pocket, and she pulls out this ring. And she says, James, will you marry me? And I said, yes, I would love to marry you. And I said, but I have to propose to you as well, and I'm not ready to propose right now. And I don't think she had planned for this possible outcome. She was ready for yes and ready for no and maybe some other options, but this one kind of threw her.
Yeah, it still sort of makes me nervous to remember it now. So I was waiting. He said, not now. He said, yes to marrying you, and I'll propose back sometime. And I didn't know what it meant. So the only person I had shared this with was my sister Haley, because Haley was getting married Labor Day weekend just a couple of months ago, and I had helped plan her wedding. So we had already like bought the toilets and the chairs and the tables and arranged the musician. And I had had this thought that like Labor Day weekend is so long. I wondered when all that stuff was being picked up from our remote tree farm in eastern Kentucky. And it turned out that it wasn't being picked up till Monday. So it seemed like there was like this whole day on Sunday where the wedding was still ready, but then nobody was getting married. So I asked Haley before I asked James, like, what do you think about sharing your wedding weekend? And she had totally fallen for the idea and thought it was lovely. And we were like busy cooking up this plan, except the only thing we had to do was ask James. And so then we asked him, but he said in a little bit. So I called Haley and I said, he said yes, but he also said I should wait. So don't tell mom. And then I guess you proposed back. I should tell that part, or you should?
I think you should. I don't know if it's really that.
It's so quick. He proposed back 3 weeks later with that text message, which he had on his phone from 3 years ago. I came in from the movies. He sat me down on the couch. He had the ring that matched my ring that we'd gotten in Ecuador on the side of the road for 50 cents. He'd made this beautiful book about the 31 reasons that he loves me, or maybe just 11. Do you remember?
No. It was in the 30s.
Okay. There were so many. And which was really validating because women don't often propose, right? So you really want to feel like you didn't talk him into it, like he wants this. And so it was just amazing to be sat down and shown that book. And then he got down on his knee and he had that text on his text messaging from some dead cell phone that somehow he was able to recharge. And I totally didn't get it. I was like, you may have found her. What?
But look at the year. Look at the date, I said.
But then the date was my mom's birthday. So I was like, I didn't get it. And then the wedding in one line.
Beautiful Kentucky tree farm, bluebird day, flowers and butterflies, bourbon, bluegrass music, fish fry with Alaskan salmon and halibut.
Perhaps the best day of my life.
That was our last story on this hour of Arctic Entries. It's almost time to tie things up, but first, one more song from Emma Hill.
If you live your life on the road, then you live your life on the gap. Count your days from station to station, mountain passes to dusty stages. I could try and settle down, make your heart my home, but God only knows where the time would take us. Just when I think I'm tired, ready to sit still, then I miss burning up my tires and these battered suitcase wheels. Oh, the blossoms, they are blooming, flying through spring air, and I am jealous of the freedom, how they fall without a care. Bet you wouldn't catch me if I fell. Maybe I'm afraid that you will. But if you live your life avoiding love, then you live your life so scared of broken hearts, codependence, that beating in your chest, and the feelings that come with it. I could try and settle down, make your heart my home, but God only knows where the time would take us. Just when I think I'm tired, ready to sit still, then I miss burning up my tires and these battered suitcase wheels. Oh, the rivers, they are flowing into winter's ravines, and they are ever moving, running from scene to scene. Oh, I bet you wouldn't stop me if I left. Maybe I'm afraid that you will. But if you live your life on the road, then you live your life on the gap. Count your days from station to station, mountain passes to dusty stages.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. On our website, we also have information about upcoming live shows, which occur the second Tuesday of each month, and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for the show, our musical guest, Emma Hill, and Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. All of the proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit organization. Information about this is also on our site.
This has been Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, wanna give me some. Will we fuss and fight when things go wrong? Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will we will be. We can swim or sing in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries going on me. No more reassuring.
Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who can ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim on the same in our new beginning.